It is the desire of every human heart to have our deepest longings met and satisfied. Our greatest obstacle to meeting these needs ourselves is that so often we try to fill our emptiness with those things that do not satisfy, that do not fill the emptiness. And it's not that our lives are always empty. They're just often full of the wrong stuff. C.S. Lewis told the truth when he said, "We are half-hearted creatures, fooling around with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased. We focus on trivia and miss what matters. I can have a rather serious craving for a ribeye at Downtown Grill. Embarrassingly so. For months, I've been hungry and thirsty for college football, and now dinner is served. Every once in a while, on my better days, I realize I can do better. Do I really need to see college game day, the 12 o'clock game, the 3:30 game, and the 7:30 game every Saturday? Yes. Yes, I do. Not really, but sometimes I think I do. On my better days, I know better. All the stuff we long for, money, entertainment, a fine reputation, a nice place to live, a secure retirement, they're all fine and good. But they're all attempts to fill an empty place. We need more. When we get what we thought we wanted, it works for a time, but then not so much. Almost everything we try, all the false hungers and thirsts, Max Lucado says they are salt water in the desert. The audience gathering around Jesus does not completely understand that they are there because they are hungry for something more. Jesus looks at them, sees what they need, and said, "Blessed are you who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for you will be filled." What exactly are we hungering and thirsting after when we long and hope for righteousness? It's not just about wanting to be a better person. It's about desiring the well-being of others. Again, with this beatitude, Jesus returns us to Isaiah 61, where we learn that righteousness is a justice that rescues those who are oppressed and restores the powerless and the outcasts. The root word of righteousness is the word from which we get the word justice, holiness. The biblical understanding of righteousness is a world where everything is in its right place. Proper relationships among people, between God and people, between people and the earth. Everything as God intended it to be. It's a personal longing to be free of sins, addictions, and cravings that threaten to tear our lives apart. It's a global longing for the whole world to be at a rightful state of peace. It's a systemic longing for all people to have access to good education and meaningful work and affordable health care. Hungering for righteousness means longing for God's righteousness in the world and in our own hearts. Justice and righteousness are more than moral ideals. They are the very power of God moving into our lives and into our world like rolling down waters and ever-flowing streams. This longing Jesus calls hunger is actually the word for starving. The kind of hunger that makes you dizzy and nauseous, so hungry you almost cannot eat. The word for thirst describes a mouth that is beyond the feeling of cotton, the dryness of a desert land. Real hunger, real thirst is the kind that changes your life. Do you long for the world to be as God intends it to be, with that kind of hunger, that kind of thirst? It's the craving to see God's right ordering of the world prevail, to conquer those systems of greed and hatred, apathy and exploitation, all that destroys human life and human dignity and creation itself. It's to cry out with the prophet Amos from the depths of your being, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Do you feel that kind of hunger? That kind of thirst for the world? It is a godly craving. In Luke's proclamation of this sermon of Jesus, he leaves off the thirsting and the righteousness. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you will be filled. Now, it's not that Matthew is saying Jesus is ignorant of physical hunger. It's just that we're given something deeper to hunger for. We need both Matthew and Luke's version of this beatitude to comprehend all that Jesus is saying. Matthew's version is about hungering and thirsting for righteousness and justice, a spiritual hunger and thirst. Luke's version is about hungry people who long to be fed. Jesus won't let us separate the spiritual from the physical. And here's the beautiful thing about Matthew's version and Luke's version side by side. The one aching for what is right will make sure that the one whose empty stomach is aching gets fed. Jesus challenges us to remember that the physical is also spiritual. If we pass by someone in need and don't feel a conflict in our spirit, then we're confused about what it means to be Christian. Gregory of Nyssa said this beatitude is talking about the spiritual food of justice. Mark Allen Powell says Jesus is calling out to those starved for justice. There are those who are hungry for food and those who are hungry for the justice that keeps people hungry for food. Later in Matthew's gospel, Jesus makes our calling plain. Come, you that are blessed by God, inherit the kingdom prepared for you before the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you gave me clothing. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me. And the righteous will answer him, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and gave you food and thirsty and gave you something to drink? And the king will answer, truly I tell you, just as you did it unto one of the least of these who are members of my family, you did it to me. When we feel an ache towards something good, but we're not sure what, that's God calling to us. When we are brave to see and not turn away, that's God waking us up. In the late 18th century, before education became public, when learning to read and write was reserved for the wealthy elite, a British newspaper reporter named Robert Raikes was working in the prisons on reform. He began to see that education was the pathway to stability, and he worried about children who had no access. So in an inspired response to the Industrial Revolution, he dreamed up a system of schooling that would support children who had to work in the factories and mines 6 days a week for more than 12 hours a day. Because their poverty gave them no choice but to work, and the government didn't yet provide any educational support, Robert designed a free school for children to learn to read and write. They'd meet once each week in volunteers' homes from 10 until 5, learning their letters and reading from their only textbook at the time, the Bible. With the support of the Anglican Church, but entirely lay-led, the Sunday school model spread across Britain. Spelling books were soon created for the working poor. Crime rates dropped. The movement in Britain was so successful that the inspiration quickly spread to the U.S. By the 1790s, the first Sunday schools opened in the U.S. in mill communities. Seeing the difference it made in British and American governments, British and American governments made education free and mandated in order to teach children who otherwise didn't have access to education. Catherine Booth was a Sunday school teacher in London when she met her husband William. He had been working on and off as a pawnbroker and doing a little preaching on the side. Turns out Catherine was a stunning preacher in her own right. And because William's work had brought him into relationship with London's poor, he was drawn to impoverished places. And in 1865, together they began the Christian mission in London's East End. Their gospel work began by taking care of people's basic needs: soup, clothing, shelter. William Booth is famously quoted saying, "You cannot warm the hearts of people with God's love if they have an empty stomach and cold feet." The Christianity they practiced was so needed. It spread across the world within decades by the name Salvation Army. The Industrial Revolution, while making a very few wealthy, made life so much harder and more dangerous for most people. In the late 18th centuries through the mid-19th centuries, Christianity was literally a life-saving force. Because of their faith in the way of Jesus, people were compelled to go be face-to-face with poverty and fill empty stomachs, inspire minds, create safe spaces. Robert Raikes' compassionate inspiration to open Sunday schools was the very early beginning of the Christian social gospel movement. The Salvation Army and the YMCA all began during this time of intense urban poverty and terrible working conditions. This was the same time a young Baptist named Walter Rauschenbusch had a theological conversion. Walter was serving as a young pastor to a German church on West 43rd Street in Manhattan. in the height of slum condition tenements and child labor and robber barons. And one day while leading yet another funeral for a child, he couldn't bear the heartbreak anymore. This isn't it, he thinks. Christianity has to mean more than this. And in his book that woke up the church, he writes, "No one shares his life with God whose religion does not flow out naturally and without effort into all relations of his life and reconstructs everything that it touches. Whoever uncouples the religious life and social need has not understood Jesus. The fundamental purpose of Jesus was the establishment of the kingdom of God, a movement pledged to change the world as it is into the world as God meant it to be." Pastor Rauschenbusch saw the pain of the world he was living in for what it was and had the courage not to look away, but to allow it to change him. He began to preach adamantly that Jesus came not just to save souls, but to mend our bodies. If Christianity didn't make a difference in people's everyday lives, if it wasn't putting food in their stomachs and socks on their feet, if it wasn't saving actual lives, he said it didn't have the power of Jesus in it. There is an unbearable amount of pain in our world. There are still too many empty stomachs and cold feet. Too many people who work 50 hours a week but have no health care and can't afford a decent place to live, while the bosses of their company make $30 million a year. Before that makes you hunger for righteousness, it should make you want to throw up. Our society is simply not set up for everyone to thrive. In fact, even today, as the stock market booms, our society is becoming less compassionate, less helpful to the poor, with essential services being cut. This hunger and this thirst for God's justice and righteousness begins with a desperate longing for God, given voice in the prayer of the psalmist, "My soul thirsts for the living God. Like a deer pants for water, so my soul thirsts for you, O God." Loving and longing for God helps create within us a life that matters around things that are important and critical. What hunger for justice burns inside of you? How would you like to see the world become different and better? The blessing of this beatitude is that those who hunger will be satisfied, filled. Both the spiritually hungry and the physically hungry will be fed. The blessing is the contentment of eating when you're hungry, seeing the hungry fed, and watching justice roll down like an ever-flowing Niagara Falls. Fed by whom? God, yes. And by God through us. When Jesus fed the 5,000, what did he start with? A young boy's 2 loaves and 5 fish. The very staples of a Near Eastern diet. Jesus didn't just conjure up the food out of thin air. The boy offered them, and Jesus multiplied them. He's doing it all the time through us. We have to also address the social systems and the structures of sin which keep so many people in the world poor and hungry. As the wise late writer Wendell Berry would say, we not only rescue people drowning at the bottom of the stream, we go upstream to see why they're falling in. Our hunger and our thirst for a different world must become a physical craving. Jesus says, blessed are you if you know what it is to hurt in the pit of your being for things to be better. Blessed are you when your body craves the world as it should be. Blessed are you when you grieve for the world the way it is so much that you give your life to God's love and desire for justice. Blessed are you when you see how the world is with all of its suffering and it disturbs your sleep and your state of mind. Blessed are you when you can't make the tension go away no matter how hard you try. That holy hunger and thirst are signs that you get it. That the world works as it is for some people, but not for everyone. When we hunger and thirst to do the right thing, that blessed craving, that ache of desire is God within us. Because it's in that place, that pain, that ache, that longing, that desire, that awareness, that hunger, that thirst, that Jesus announces the kingdom will satisfy you. These challenging days in which we live are an opportunity. They call us to have the courage and imagination to picture our lives and the lives of others in a new and better way. The world becomes a better place when we imagine the world as it could be and decide to use our power for good. When we can't not go, serve, do, share, that's God filling us up with the beauty of a new world. And then when we can't keep going, when we have to rest, that's God proving to us that God is still God. It's not up to us to save the world. Jesus has already done that. It is up to us to crave the world Jesus talks about and go after it so we can be filled with joy, hope, love, gratitude, the gifts of God's kingdom for us, even now. May it be so.